when we thought about it. So, yeah. Cool. Yes, good catch. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just opened the meeting, so. I probably wouldn't open it because I know, hi. yeah, it probably wouldn't let you open it because I hadn't started the call yet. Yeah, nope, you're good. I am here. We're here together. Bye.
That was Stevie watching me talk to her. Hey everybody, we are just getting set up. We're going to start in about 6 minutes, so hopefully you're here for the Fair Housing Act training. So that's what's happening. If not, hang out. It'll be fun.
Wow. I just caught a typo on the third slide, man.
Let's see. We're going to hold it against you.
Sorry to everyone who got that sent to them.
I didn't see it either, Dylan. Sorry.
Oh, don't worry. Am I moving? Probably.
And yes, everybody is muted from this point right now. I haven't unmuted anybody yet. So we know you're there. I know you can talk. We'll get it in just a second. Oh, sorry. I know. I'm no fun. Some of my friends call me the fun police.
Well, yeah. Somebody has to be the fun police.
No. I don't know when I became old enough to not be the fun one. It's disappointing. Hey guys, so we're going to, in about 2 minutes, go ahead and get started. So if you'll hang out a bit longer, please note there's closed caption at the bottom if you need that. It's in the CC box. It should be at the bottom of your screen. If you scroll over, the menu bar should pop up. Hey guys, we're going to get started in about 1 minute. You're here hopefully for the Fair Housing Act training, the youth training. And we'll get started in about one more minute. Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. Good afternoon, everybody. I am Sierra Royster, the April's Youth Program Coordinator. I want to thank everyone for joining us today. This is a training hosted by the April's Youth Advocacy Committee in efforts to continuously learn more of the rights and responsibilities we have under the laws that protect us to be stronger advocates. So this is the Fair Housing Act Youth Training Part 3. The Part 1 and Part 2 were sent to you on the email invitation to this one, so hopefully you got that and you can refer back to that. Please know that that will be on the website as well once this is all concluded, so you can go back and reference that. We are hoping that this training will help young individuals looking for that transition, that first transition or maybe the second or third transition, or entering the independent living in general, give some of that knowledge to be able to help with that. This training is sponsored by the Research and Training Center on Independent Living at the University of Kansas. So we thank them for supporting us in supporting youth. Today's call will be a webinar system. You can follow along with the PowerPoint materials that were sent to you, along with the call-in information, or you can also jump onto the call on the webinar platform, and that will give you the ability to see our speakers if you would like, but also to join into the chat as well. And if you run into any issues throughout the call, please let me know. I will drop my information into the chat box below. But if you're on the phone, it's April, A-P-R-I-L, dash Sierra, S-I-E-R-R-A, at att.net, N-E-T. So, and I'll drop that in the chat box as well. Today, as long as you have downloaded the latest version of Zoom, you will be able to join us via microphone if you are on the webinar platform. And I will go ahead and enable those in just a bit. So you may hear that you've been enabled to talk. Please note that I may mute you. If there's some feedback, then you've unmuted yourself. I may go through and mute everybody, but please know that you can unmute yourself. If you're on the phone, you can do that by pressing star 6 from your phone, or if you're on the webinar platform, you can go to the bottom of the screen. If you scroll over the bottom, that will pop up a menu bar. To the very left will give you the microphone option. We also have the option of star 9 if you're on the phone and you want to raise your hand rather than jumping into the conversation. I can note that you have a question or a comment and we can go to you at that point. Please remember, though, if you do join into the conversation, which we hope that you do, we ask you to keep the background noise down so we can hear you clearly. But please remember, we do encourage you to jump in. The audio recording from today's webinar and transcript will be sent to you, and it will also, like I said, be up on the website as well. We also have CART available, so if you are online, if you go to the bottom toolbar again, scroll over that, and that menu bar will pop up. Sometimes it likes to disappear. You'll see a CC option, and that will give you closed captioning. If you do not like that option, if you prefer a full screen, please go back to the email that was sent to you with the login information, and you will find the stream text link in that email as well. And I will be dropping that into the chat box as well in just a bit. It's just going to take me a minute or two. So without all those things out of the way, let me hand it over to Don, Dew, and Dylan for another week of Fair Housing Act. So thank you guys for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm sharing and present. Okay, cool. So welcome everyone. Today we are going to be talking about reasonable accommodation, making your space livable and workable for yourself, for individuals with disabilities in particular. And the reason that we talk about this is because apartments can be pretty basic when you first begin your search. A lot of larger apartment complexes have one or two floor plans that you can choose from without much customization options. And if you go to try to rent a house or a bedroom in a house, again, everything comes how it is, and it's hard to be able to get and make an adjustment or a modification if that's something you need. Which, if you have a disability, that can be a problem. Most living spaces were built with the able-bodied person in mind, and oftentimes have stairs or narrow doorways, or are just, for many reasons, not suitable for a person with a disability without some modification. And one of the departments that oversees fair housing and ensures that that housing discrimination is not occurring is the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, as we call it. And on their website, in their section on reasonable accommodation, there is this quote. It says, rules, policies, practices, and services may have a different effect on persons with disabilities than other persons. And because of that, treating persons with disabilities exactly the same as others will sometimes deny those people with disabilities equal opportunity to enjoy their dwelling or participation in the program. And so this is important because when we talk about reasonable accommodation, something that often gets brought up is that it's special treatment or that it's separate but equal, which we had already decided with Brown versus the Board of Education is not something that we can do. That's a form of discrimination, treating people separately. But because those policies in and of themselves are exclusionary to many people with disabilities, the modification is necessary in order to afford that person with a disability equal access. And so that's why accommodation and modification is not only legal, but advocated for in housing for people with disabilities. And with that, I will turn it over to Don to explain more about reasonable accommodation.
Thank you, Dylan. So when we're talking about a reasonable accommodation, you know, we're talking about any type of change with a disability to really utilize.
Hey Don, I'm actually going to
enjoy their living space.
Hey Don, sorry, I'm actually going to cut you off. You're breaking up pretty bad.
Am I?
Yeah, you were doing fine earlier, and now it doesn't like you.
I am going to.
You'll have to change the microphone setting.
Hello?
Okay.
Can you hear me?
We'll try this one. Yep.
Can you hear me now?
Yep, we can hear you.
Hey, all right.
thanks.
So a reasonable accommodation, when you're asking for that, it's a change or an exception or an adjustment that is necessary for a person with a disability to utilize and enjoy their living space just like everybody else. It's making an even playing field for everybody. And why these reasonable accommodation laws apply to both the inside the dwelling as well as any public or common use areas. And they include such areas as entryways. So say from the street to where your doorway is.
Yeah, and I chose most of these pictures because of certain accessibility deficits in these areas. Like if you look at this entryway, it looks like we've got two pretty heavy wooden doors, and it doesn't appear that there is a button that you can push to have those doors open. So that in and of itself would be an issue for some people.
Right, and you could actually have somebody test the strength of the doors so they're not 15-pound, you know, under 15-pound weight. They don't necessarily need to have a push button. That's not required. But there are advantages for special tax exemptions and credits for the landlord to be able to do that. Hallways and stairways especially need to be accessible. Stairways, we're talking about being accessible as far as if somebody has a mobility impairment, if they use a cane, a limp, something where they need to make sure that the rails on the stairs are strongly put in. There's no tears in any of the carpet, or if it's wood, you do not have any unfinished areas or cracks in the stairs, but it has to be smooth going for everybody that is walking, and that makes it apply to everybody. I mean, there again, it's not a special accommodation, really. It helps everyone.
Yes. And again, I chose this picture because on the stairwell, you can see there's a railing on one side, but not on the other. And right. They chose to put it on the shorter wall. And so it doesn't even quite go all the way down to the bottom of the stairs, it seems. And so if my partner was walking up or down those stairs, they would have some difficulty doing that by themselves without assistance because of that railing issue.
And parking lots, besides having to have enough accessible parking spaces and, van accessible parking spaces, they need to make sure that there's curb cuts, there's, I see there's a question from Stevie. Is there a certain width of the stairs? Usually,
that's determined more by building code. I don't think that the ADA specifies a stairwell width.
I have not seen anything that has the stairway. But, so with parking lots, making sure also that there's curb cuts within a good amount of space also, especially near the accessible areas, but also at least at the end of each sidewalk, making sure then the parking lots are smooth, the sidewalks are smooth, there's no cement that has come up during the wintertime, anything like that that would be an impediment to anybody walking or rolling over that. And laundry facilities. You know, one of the things that people don't think about, especially, are, you know, washers and dryers that are within the reach of people in wheelchairs. And that is one thing that can be asked for if they are not. It would not be an undue burden, depending on the size of the facility. And most places that have people with disabilities that stay at apartment buildings do have washers and dryers that are able to be reached in and used by people in chairs. But they also have to be kept clean. They have to be kept free of any tiles that come up. Any spills have to be cleaned. It has to be kept so there's basically, just like anything else, you don't want anybody falling. There needs to not be a trip hazard for anybody. And signage, oh, that's such a big one too, because signage not only needs to be able to be seen by a variety of people, but making sure that there's Braille on signs is very, very important. If there is not Braille, that is something that really needs to have somebody come out and talk to the people who own the apartment buildings or manage them about, because there are going to be people who are blind or people who have lost are losing their sight that are learning Braille, that is actually their way to be able to do anything, to get into an apartment or into it, so they know that what floor they're on, what floor, is this the garbage area, is it the laundry area? I don't know. It makes me angry on how few things actually think about Braille, large enough signage or signage at all. So that's just a pet peeve of mine.
Yes. And so in addition to the physical accommodations of the apartment and the spaces around it, accommodation also applies to any policies or practices that might pose a barrier to a person with a disability. So this could involve things like communication disabilities, which would affect application submission. If your application to apply for an apartment is online, and your website is designed in a way that is not accessible to a screen reader, so someone who is blind is not able to navigate that website, input their information, that's going to be an issue, and you need to have some other alternate submission form for that person. Or if someone needs to adjust their rent payment schedule based on when their Social Security benefits arrive, that is a reasonable accommodation. If your rent is due on the 1st, but your benefits arrive on the 3rd, that's going to be a problem. It's going to be a consistent problem, and you will be consistently late in paying your rent. And so you can ask for that accommodation to adjust when your rent is due based on your Social Security disbursement schedule. Landlords cannot refuse to rent to a tenant because they have disabilities that require an accommodation. It's illegal. That's what the Fair Housing Fair Housing Act says. People cannot be discriminated or excluded from an apartment because they have a disability, even if that disability requires modification or accommodation on the part of the landlord. Ooh, I just realized we had a question about laundry. Is it a reasonable accommodation to request washer and dryer hookups added to an apartment one is unable to get their laundry facilities on site? I would say probably not. That's probably going to be an expense that you would have to take on yourself if the landlord would even let you make that alteration. See, and that's sort of, I think, a larger discussion to think about when talking about accommodation is trying to determine, is this apartment a good fit where we can make a few changes? Or do we maybe need to look for someplace more suitable? And if your disability is such that it requires a laundry unit inside of your apartment, then that's, I think, just maybe something that you should look for from the outset. But great question. So it's illegal to refuse to rent to a tenant solely because of their disability. And I think I skipped one. And landlords cannot place any special conditions or fees on tenants who require accommodation or modification. So we'll talk about later on, most often the cost of the labor and the installation does sometimes go on to the tenant. You may have to pay for the materials, but they cannot say, well, you have a modification fee added to this because I had to go out of my way, or your security deposit's double because I'm going to have to take this out. That, because that is discrimination. It's treating someone differently because of their disability.
Service animals. Now, service animals are specific type of animals. There any animal that has received specific training to assist a person, so they have to have a specific task that they do. So like a CNI dog, a stability animal, a seizure response animal. I had a seizure assistance dog at one point. There's animals that do diabetes too. They know when people are going in to, they have low blood sugar. So there are service animals that do have specific training in different areas.
Yes. There are also animals that have been trained to respond to PTSD symptoms as well, and anxiety attacks. And that's, it feels like that's often they won't get grouped with emotional support animals, but they have been trained in a specific task. And if they have that training, then they're a service animal.
Right. So, and that means that, you know, landlords, they might try, and a lot do, but they cannot refuse you if you have a service animal. Fair housing is something that absolutely says that service animals are not pets, they're attendants. You cannot be charged a deposit You cannot be charged an extra monthly fee for having a service animal. Landlords get fined by like human rights commissions, by HUD, by other investigation agencies all the time for not complying with these rules. So it's important to let people know if that is going on. So, you know, emotional support animals are different. They're allowed under the Fair Housing Act. They have not received specific training, but usually a licensed clinical professional has recommended you need that to help treat such things as mental illness, depression, other types of illness also. So it's something that you need that they recommend, and it still is the same as having a service animal, in the fact that landlords cannot refuse emotional support animals or charge pet deposits, monthly fee, extra rent, anything, because of the emotional support animals. And that's very important. But there are some things that you have to do if you do have an emotional support animal. What I've seen, and like here it says, you can pay lots of different services to have your animal certified as an emotional support animal. And then this next picture shows certificates. It shows vests. It shows like a dog tag that says emotional support animal. These actually don't mean anything. That's very important to know, because I have people come in all the time with their emotional support animal that they've had certified through the internet. They've paid $99, $99.99. The dog has had no training. It's not any type of emotional support animal, except they decided that it was a support animal for them. And there's a difference. So just putting a vest or having a certificate is a little bit different than having a certificate, or I'm sorry, a letter written by your doctor. And it says here, if you don't have a letter from a therapist, counselor, doctor, psychiatrist, your animal is not an emotional support animal. And there's a sample of the letter, and I don't know if y'all can read it, but like here, it's written out to the landlord, and it says, you know, dear landlord, and then it has the tenant's name. They're my patient, has been under my care since whatever date. I'm familiar with his or her history, with the functional limitations imposed by his or her disability. He or she meets the definition of disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Fair Housing Act, and the Rehabilitation Act. Due to a disability, this person has certain limitations regarding social interaction, coping with stress, anxiety, etc. In order to alleviate with these difficulties and to enhance his or her ability to live independently and to fully use and enjoy the dwelling unit you own or administer, I am prescribing an emotional support animal that will assist them in coping with his or her disability. Having that letter is what you need to give to either the landlord, the apartment manager, whomever. It legitimizes the animal that you have. And if you, here's a picture of an anteater in a vest that Dylan stuck in there. If you do have a letter from a professional, you don't have to pay for certification, or get a vest for your animal. It's not necessary. It's that letter that is the legitimacy. And that's what we need to tell people when they're looking for houses, or if you're looking for a house or an apartment, that is the most important.
Yes. And when we talk about who this is applicable for, what landlords are responsible for making these accommodations and following these laws, it's any person or company who rents a property with the intention of someone else living in it. So if you rent a building from someone to open a donut shop, right, they don't have to make sure that the bathroom is accessible. They don't have to make these accommodations. But if you're renting a house, they know that you are going to be living in there. It's the landlord's responsibility to undertake these accommodations. And it applies to a person or a company. So it doesn't matter if this is an individual landlord who only has one unit that they're renting out, or a huge complex. Anyone who is renting out an apartment or a house has to follow this. And as far as who pays for the accommodation, most often the cost of the modification is paid for by the tenant, which is, in my opinion, unfortunate, but that is sort of how it goes. And landlords are able to request verification in certain instances in order to verify that the modification you're asking for is because of your disability. One of those things might be the letter that Don was just talking about to certify your emotional support animal. But in most cases, from what I have seen, it tends to err on the side of believing the tenant over asking for more proof. And landlords are not really able to ask for invasive medical records or things that would get into details about your specific medical history, but they could just get a letter from a doctor saying, because of mobility difficulties, this is a necessary accommodation. Okay. So we are going to talk about some scenarios. So everyone open up your chat box, make sure that you're able to type in there if possible. So we're going to talk about 5 different people and their new apartments and some modifications they would like to request from their landlord. I want you to type in the chat box if you think that it's a reasonable request or if it's an unreasonable request based on all of the things we've talked about so far. Okay, so scenario 1 is Jordan. Jordan is looking for a wheelchair accessible apartment, and she found a great 1-bedroom with no stairs at the front door so she can wheel herself in. And all the hallways and doors are large enough for her chair to fit through. But she needs a grab bar to get in and out of the bathtub, and she asks her landlord to install that grab bar. Is that reasonable or is that unreasonable? Reasonable. Yeah, this one is definitely reasonable because it's a very minor modification, doesn't take away from the value of the unit, very little effort on the part of the landlord to install, and it can make a huge difference to the person who lives there. So definitely reasonable. Scenario 2, Kira loves her new apartment, but there's a step to get up into the building that doesn't have a railing. And sometimes she feels like she's going to fall when she goes in or out. So she asked her landlord to install a railing near that step. What do you think? Is that reasonable or is that unreasonable? Okay, it looks like people might be a little slower on responding to this one. But yeah, this one would still be reasonable request because that step is an impediment and it can be a significant safety risk to that person. And again, the effort on the part of the landlord to install that would be pretty low. Okay, scenario number three, Fred. So Fred isn't so sure about his new place. His kitchen is way too tiny and he can barely turn around in his wheelchair. He has a hard time getting close enough to the sink or the stove to use them. And so Fred asked his landlord to remodel the kitchen, make it fully wheelchair accessible. What do you think? Reasonable or unreasonable? Okay, so we've got four unreasonable and one reasonable. So Patrick, if you are able and if you would like to, I'd love to hear your explanation of why you differ from everyone else.
And Patrick, I can unmute you if you'd like. So Patrick, you're unmuted if you want to go ahead.
Sarah?
Yeah. Hey.
No, yeah, no. I typed in the wrong answer. It's all right.
Okay, yeah. This would be one of those unreasonable scenarios, right? If the kitchen is something that's not going to fit, right? That's maybe time to look for a more suitable apartment.
Right.
Asking for a whole kitchen remodel, that's a large burden to place upon a landlord. Okay. Scenario number four, Sky. The inside of Sky's new apartment is great, but they have a problem outside with the parking lot. Nobody has an assigned spot, and sometimes guests come over and park in the extra spots, so that Sky has to walk from down the block. And yesterday, Sky fell trying to get back to their building from their car. They asked their landlord to assign one dedicated accessible parking spot near the apartment entrance. What do you think about that? Reasonable or unreasonable? Okay, so we've got a couple reasonable, and then Joanna says unreasonable. This coordinator says each tenant should be assigned a spot if they're going to do so. Okay, so yeah, this is an interesting conversation. If they're going to assign parking spots, then maybe they should just assign one per unit. But I think that it would even be reasonable to just assign one spot that is for accessible parking. What do you think, Don?
I absolutely think they should. And, you know, you can have a talk with them about what is necessary, depending on their size of their lot, too, because then they'd be required to have at least one. It's not all, even if it is reasonable, it's not always that they will do it. So we have that argument here in my city all the time. So, but they should be having accessible parking spots.
And Stevie says, shouldn't there be a certain number of accessible parking per number of parking spaces? Yes, at larger apartment buildings, but sometimes smaller complexes, smaller buildings where there's like 10 to 20 units are not always regulated quite as well.
Right.
So this is Sierra. I actually have a question about that. So if the apartment complex has a parking lot and says, you know, you can get a parking spot if you pay extra, there's a parking lot you can choose to pay in, or you can, you know, have one of the upfront by paying for that. If that person needed an accessible parking spot and they were told they had to pay for it then, because they were asking for a specific spot, would they have to pay for it? Sorry.
You could ask for the accommodation, but I feel like probably they'll make you pay for it. What do you think, Don?
So, When I asked the DOJ that exact question, they No, you do not have to. You should not have to pay for an accommodation.
That's okay. Good.
Cool. Okay, scenario five. So Abe wants to move into a beautiful old house with his friends. He really likes the place, but all of the bedrooms are upstairs. He can't get up the stairs. So he asked his landlord to install a stair lift to help him get up the stairs to the bedrooms. Reasonable? Unreasonable? Okay, seems like we've got some differing opinions. And some people are just taking a while to respond. This is a tough one. What do you think, Don? Reasonable, unreasonable?
I think what he would have to do is pay for the stairlift. If the landlord would be willing to install it, that would be great. He will have to promise to have it taken out when he leaves. That's the whole conundrum of these types of things, because the next person will probably not need that. And when you do accommodations like that, the landlord does not have to do that. But he can pay. Abe could pay for it.
Yeah, but Ian, even if the landlord did approve it, it would still probably be coming out of Abe's pocket. And that's a huge expense. So again, there are times when you have to reconsider, is this going to be a suitable place for me to live, or do I need to find somewhere else that's going to be more appropriate? What if your landlord doesn't want to accommodate? All right, this is an important, before we move on, Stevie said, do you need to remove grab bars to go back to the first question? Most often, yes. Most of the time, landlords request that you remove them, which I don't really understand, because I think, it's useful for anyone. It adds value to the apartment.
Right.
So if your landlord doesn't want to accommodate, because a lot of these examples that I have listed, asking for an accessible parking space, asking for a railing near an outdoor stair, these are accommodations that my partner has requested before and has been denied by their landlord. So just because these laws exist doesn't necessarily mean they're always being followed. And landlords kind of bank on the fact that most people will not come back after a first request, and they won't look into their rights enough to know that they're being swindled. But ignoring a reasonable accommodation request is discrimination, and that is illegal both under the Fair Housing Act and Section 504. So it's illegal for a landlord to just flat out deny an accommodation that is deemed to be reasonable, that's necessary for the person to fully enjoy their apartment. And yet it happens incredibly frequently, more often than you would assume. So because of that fact, we're going to be talking next week about resolving conflict with your landlord, what to do if you experience housing discrimination. Contact Disability Rights, there are lots of different organizations that you can contact, and we'll discuss that a little bit more next week. But what questions do you have in regards to accommodation? You can use the chat box, or if you want to unmute yourself.
And remember, if you're on the computer, you can go to the bottom of the screen and click the little microphone to the left, and that will unmute you.
if people are still marinating on questions, there's one point I wanted to bring up, is the difference in the rules around accommodation and modification based on Fair Housing Act laws versus Section 504, because they are different and they apply in different circumstances. So Fair Housing Act laws apply all of the time to anyone who is renting out an apartment. So that applies to individual landlords. But Section 504 is specifically talking about public housing or any housing program that gets money from the federal government. And because 504 says that they cannot fundamentally alter the program in order to make that accommodation, a lot of times it can be more difficult to request an accommodation in a federally funded housing program, because it can often be times be considered an alteration of the program because it's not being done to everyone. It's not a change that's being provided to everyone. So that does raise a couple of barriers.
Very true.
It's 504 is under civil rights law. It's a section of the Rehabilitation Act, I believe, from 1973, which that law said that any program, any government entity that gets money from the federal government, it cannot exclude people based on disability. So that means any housing program that gets money from the federal government. Yeah. What other questions have we got?
And so remember, this is a time also, if you have specific accommodation questions, or this is the time where we've left quite a bit of time for you to ask some of those questions, either individualized or consumers that you may be working with. And if you have any questions too, in regards to how does this work with young people, what is often, you know, barriers that they come up against as well? Or maybe how do you communicate this? Which maybe that's a good question too, actually, that I probably have. How would you suggest people go back and communicate this, since it is so in depth? Share just this webinar, or?
I think it's twofold, because there is the knowing your rights aspect, like being able to teach someone what their rights are and what the landlord is able to do versus what they aren't. And there's also the advocacy level, because just a tenant in talking to a landlord, there's a huge power difference there. And the landlord is able to use that power in order to just sort of turn the tenant away a lot of the time. And so having another person there, a person with authority from an organization who can say, no, this person is right, this is the law, I think can be really powerful and is very helpful. So that's where any staff who are currently watching this, that's where your role, I think, is particularly important. How can you educate it to young people? Well, that was the goal of this webinar. The whole reason we designed this, we tried to make this in mind with people with disabilities, youth with disabilities, trying to make it easily digestible and understandable. So then all of these webinars will be available online, I believe. So if you want to take them and share them, maybe take some information, modify them based on the needs and abilities of the people that you're working with. I think, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's very important, especially if you have any youth advocacy groups in your own center, to start talking about that, because then that starts with building that whole advocacy and knowledge base about housing and how housing works, but then still having somebody from your center or somebody from an organization going with as an advocate to either a landlord or to a housing agency like Section 8 to talk about, yes, these are the rights. This is the person that is, you know, doing this. I am here as an advocate. But then they know that somebody has that person's back, and, you know, they're less likely to discriminate in that time. So
one session of my summer program is dedicated to this topic. Cool. I love that. I think it's really important to talk about.
And I think one thing to remember, like, this was targeted towards young people and as Dylan said, digestible pieces. You know, even where we start off with definitions, but understanding that this is a very surface level, because when you start talking about a law that affects every state differently and how it's implemented, who's overseeing what, you know, what other resources that you may have in your community, that is very individualized, not even to state sometimes. Sometimes it's community to community. So I would encourage, if you are wanting to take this and kind of use this for young people going forward, yes, use this. And then do some digging in your local community as well. Maybe bring in some of those people if you can't get those young people to those organizations or agencies to talk about what this looks like in your community. Bring in peers that do live on their own, that have asked for reasonable accommodations and been denied, or that have been approved, and what was their process like? I would encourage those pieces as well. Because reasonable accommodations is so broad, as Don's face alludes to. it's such a broad conversation because we all need such different things. So definitely, you know, think about who's in your group as well. If you're wanting to talk to young people, what accommodations do they have right now and where they live? What would that look like when they move out on their own? Those would be some of the ways that I'd try to expand on what we did here. I hope that helps. All right. Well, does anybody else have any other questions on things that you've run into or that you just randomly have questions about? That's kind of what I ask a lot. I like to just see how smart Don and Dylan are.
I would love to hear any tips for getting landlords to actually make accommodations, because I more frequently than not have run into landlords who don't want to do anything. So if anyone has stories of success stories of how they've been able to convince a landlord, would love to hear them.
Well, that's great. Yeah. Yeah. So what are you guys successful at? Since you don't have the questions, you must have the answers. What's worked for you all? And remember, you can talk outside of just chatting on the chat by going to the bottom of your screen and pressing the mute, or just raising your hand and I can unmute you.
I'm raising my hand, Sarah.
Oh, okay. Sorry. You're physically raising your hand. I see it. Go ahead.
So I don't know how many communities do a landlord and tenant disability housing training, but like we do in Sioux City. We do that in conjunction with the Sioux City Human Rights Commission, and that convinces and brings to light a lot of problem areas and then solutions with landlords and tenants. And so landlords get, like, they get credit for coming to that too. It's something that then if I have to go mediate something between a tenant and a landlord, it also, we have that relationship.
Would you say that's a good relationship? Or
yeah, it actually is.
I see Stevie wrote in there emotional support animals, a note from a doctor, grab bars, not issue, and washer and dryer hookups, assistance from a coworker. Stevie, can you expand on that, of what you mean by those things? And you're unmuted, so you could just talk if you want. Are waiting. Thank you, Don, for that.
Sure. I don't know if that was helpful, but
yeah. I think any and all information were coming up. No, we cannot hear you.
No.
Might have to go to your microphone and select the microphone that you're using. There's a little arrow beside it, and it says you can select which one you want to use. No, still can't.
You know, I was just, when I think about reasonable accommodations, I think about the time that I went to a fair housing conference, which was primarily attended by landlords. And the hour-long session talking about accommodation was mostly landlords asking questions of how they could legally deny accommodations. So it's yeah. Good to be armed with legal knowledge yourself, because then you can point to specific policies, you can point to specific organizations that will protect you and say, no, this is what the law says and this is what my rights are.
And this is just a question too from saying that. Do you, in your experiences, do you feel like landlords just feel like this is a burden that they cannot afford, that are unreasonable? Or is your experience that...
Frankly, I think landlords are in the business of making money. They're not particularly concerned with the needs of housing people. And the more effort and energy they have to expend on helping, taking care of a tenant, the more grouchy they're likely to be. Real estate most often is a business people go into because it's pretty easy money. You just have to maintain the building. And when one individual person has needs that are different than others, that can be a bit of a nuisance to some landlords.
Right. Sometimes you have to get past the manager of, say, an apartment complex and get to that corporate level, and then just tell them, this is what is in the Fair Housing Act. This is what we need, and go at it from there, because the managers of the complexes, they're not going to do anything. But yeah, I mean, like Dylan said, it's a money business. They will do the least amount of work, and yeah, the least amount of work required.
And so one thing that the reason I always ask that is because, usually in advocating, if you can know why somebody is standing in their position that is not the same as yours, it gives you a little bit more leverage to appeal to that reason of, you know, I know this isn't really what you wanted to do. So, you know, I looked it up and it turns out that this company will do this and, you know, it just costs this much. And, you know, doing some of the work can maybe build a positive relationship of like, hey, they're going to do part of this. I'm not sure what's going on with you, Stevie. but yeah, so to your point, I think it's just helpful to know sometimes why the other side feels that way. That's what the good old game of stand and declare has taught me all these years. When you play a game and learn the other side and the other point. And Stevie also added, a coworker here spoke to someone at the complex and she was successful about a washer and dryer. So that you were giving examples of things that had been done.
Oh, very nice.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, We're not going to force anybody else to talk. Thank you all for joining, though, and thank you for asking the questions and being a part of the conversation today. Reasonable accommodations are kind of one of those things that you don't need to know it until you need to know it. And so it's always good to have it in your back pocket and also a resource as well. So thank you, Don and Dylan, for just being so smart on these items and helping us walk through it. We do have our next training next week. So welcome you all to come to that. That's going to be on May 23rd, 3:00 Eastern time, wherever that may fall for you. And we're going to be covering the trouble in paradise. So the areas of where do we start building those healthy relationships and what happens when they go awry. So thank you for that. You will be getting this recording out when you get the information to log into the next one. So just be on the lookout for that. And thank you both again. And we'll be in touch soon.
Thank you.